welcome to Environmentalism Behind Bars, an interview with political prisoner Trey Arrow. Produced at Praxis Production Studios. On March 13th, 2004, the security guard in Victoria, BC arrested Trey Arrow, the FBI's most wanted domestic eco-terrorist. 30-year-old Arrow has been fighting extradition to the U.S., alleging media hysteria around terrorism makes a fair trial impossible. He has applied for refugee status in Canada. Arrow has a long history of non-violent environmental activism. In 2001, he ran for Congress as the Green Party's candidate in Oregon. He was also involved with the struggle to stop logging at Eagle Creek. The FBI accuses him of masterminding an Earth Liberation Front action, burning cement trucks and logging equipment. If convicted in the U.S., Arrow faces 80 years in prison.
It comes down to the fact that I'm being framed and I'm being targeted.
On February 8th, 2005, Chris Arsenault spoke with Trey from the North Fraser Pretrial Center in Vancouver. They spoke about his case, prison life, and environmentalism.
What are the exact charges you're facing in the U.S., and where and when do they stem from?
Yeah, basically the FBI has these crimes that they're alleging I was involved with. They're stemming from Portland, Oregon, or around the Portland area in Oregon in the U.S. They stem from two different incidents. One that took place in on April 15th of 2001, and then another that took place on June 1st of 2001. The first incident in April of 2001, basically a sand and gravel company was targeted, and there were some cement trucks that were torched and burned. That incident was related to the Eagle Creek timber sale, and the contractor that was contracted by the company who purchased the sale, Vanport Manufacturing, purchased it from the Forest Service, and then they contract out logging companies to go in and actually kill the trees and haul them out. And that company that was contracted by Vanport is Schopert Logging, and on June 1st, some of the logging trucks on Schopert Logging's property were torched, and a front end loader, some kind of front end loader device, I'm not exactly sure what kind of device it was, but that was torched as well. So, stemming from these two incidences, I'm facing about 17 charges, about eight per incident. They range from conspiracy to commit arson to actual charges for the number of trucks that were torched. Basically, arson against this truck with such and such license plate number and so forth. I'm also charged with possession of an incendiary device, even though, again, there's no evidence, there's no forensic evidence, fingerprints, I was never caught with any kind of device at all. I was never even arrested on these charges, actually. But just by the three people that already pled guilty, claiming that I was involved with this and claiming that I helped to build these devices, then they have charged me with possession of an incendiary device, even though, again, I haven't been in possession of one. And then I'm also faced with something that the other three didn't face, which is a very key element in this case. I'm faced with what is known as basically a kingpin charge. Just for the record, it's the formal documentation of it is Title 18 U.S.C. Section 924 in the U.S. Code, I believe. And basically this charge states that if one is guilty of arson and a conspiracy to commit arson, that the minimum is 30 years, and if there's two accounts, the minimum is life. And this resulted from the Oklahoma City bombing and the legislation that was passed subsequently. And so anytime that the prosecution, the U.S. government, federal government, FBI wants to slap this on someone, they can, and that's what they're doing to me. From that, if one is charged with a combination of arson and conspiracy to commit arson, then the minimum sentencing for that one charge is 30 years. And if there happens to be two charges or two incidents, which there are, then the minimum, if I'm found guilty on just that one charge, or in this case it would be those two charges, the minimum is life. So they literally are trying to lock me up for minimal my life, one lifetime, because that these are just a couple charges. Doesn't even say anything about the minimums and the maximums of the other charges. You know, again, this is what the FBI has slapped me with, even though the other three were not charged with this.
What evidence do they actually have, as far as you know, linking you to these crimes? And moreover, just from your position in prison, how do you make of the overall strength legally of their case?
First of all, there is no evidence on the as far as any fingerprints, any forensic evidence. I was never caught committing these crimes or even possessing any materials that were part of these crimes. Strictly, the evidence resides in the testimony of these three people that have already pled guilty. Like I said, the indictments came down in August of 2002, and I was traveling through the U.S. at the time, and then later I ended up coming to Canada and have been in Canada ever since. So I've never even been arrested for these charges. So even though there is no forensic evidence, no fingerprints, no hard evidence, apparently, according to my legal counsel, having even one person saying that I was involved to not only accidentally but possibly convict me, and now if there's three people saying it and their stories are all relatively the same, then they have a fairly strong case. The thing is, though, is that there are some discrepancies between what the three are saying, and I don't know exactly how this is going to pan out in court, and as far as my defense goes, but anybody that knows me and knows me well, and especially in the activist community, knows that I don't burn anything. I don't even burn dead twigs in the woods to keep warm in the wintertime, because it creates a certain amount of carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, let alone burning gasoline and plastics and tires that just emit a horrible amount of toxins. Another thing is that Jake, who was one of the, well, I don't want to say he was the main person, but basically he was the one that implicated myself and the other two folk that were found guilty. And he did this interview with the Willamette Week. That's a somewhat of an independent paper in Portland, Oregon. It's not necessarily alternative or even more, quote, left-wing. It's still, in some level, very, very conservative, not quite as conservative as the Oregonian. And there was this article that they did on Jake, and it basically lambasted me and accused me of basically brainwashing this guy to follow my kind of lifestyle and pressured him into committing these crimes. And a lot of the things that were discussed in that article are just absolutely outrageous.
Who are these three people, and where and moreover, why are they saying the things they're saying about you?
You know, to be honest, Chris, it's hard for me to answer that. You know, I can guess, but I'm a little bit in the dark as to, you know, exactly how things have transpired and the reasons, because, you know, to be honest, I know all three of them. I knew them before. I spent some time with them, not a large amount of time, but I did spend some time with Jake and a little bit of time with Jeremy and Angie. And they, you know, I haven't talked to them or seen them, though, in what amounts to now is almost 4 years. So the thing is that I think, you know, again, what I can assume and what I feel in my heart is that, I mean, obviously Jake did this stuff. I mean, he told his girlfriend and he pled guilty and all that. I think what happened was, you know, the FBI got to them, you know, because, you know, initially when the indictments came down, he wasn't saying the types of things that he later said. As far as my knowledge goes, all three of them were scheduled to go to trial. And then, you know, through the course of the next month that followed the indictments, and again, it came down in August 13th, I believe it was, 2002. You know, throughout September and October, you know, I think what happened was the FBI worked their little magic and coercion that they you know, have been extremely, you know, infamous for doing, and have coerced and pressured, you know, Jake, not only pleading guilty, but also to implicate me. I think it's extremely important to look at the fact that they were, all of them were facing a maximum of 80 years, and in order to implicate me, again, it could have been part of the whole entire coercion and pressure from the FBI to implicate me, and, you know, their sentencing was less than 4 years, and I think that's very telling as far as what could have transpired, you know, behind closed doors with the FBI and such. And I think, you know, as far as the other two, as far as Angie and Jeremy go, you know, again, I do, according to my knowledge, there is some discrepancy between what the two of them are saying and what Jake has said. It comes down to the fact that I'm being framed and I'm being targeted. It's a pretty dismal looking outcome. That, as far as the charges and being able to beat the charges, it's definitely a huge uphill battle.
In 2000, you were involved in a high-profile ledge set at the U.S. Forest Service building in Portland to draw attention to logging at Eagle Creek. Shortly after the 11-day set, community pressure stopped the federal timber sale. Tell us about the struggle for Eagle Creek and how your activism won you a place on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted.
You know, when I was on the ledge set that happened, which a lot of folks know about, in, you know, July 7th of 2000, during the course of me being on that ledge, the FBI, I have a bit of inside knowledge that the FBI had labeled me as a domestic terrorist during that ledge sit. While I was up on the ledge not hurting a fly, you know, it caught international attention, and it turned a lot of people's heads, and it woke a lot of people up, and it definitely was a key factor which resulted in the cancellation of the sale. They literally targeted me from that time on, and it was just a matter of time before they tried to pin, you know, some kind of huge crime and charges on me so that they could silence me, or try to silence me anyway. As far as the ledge sit goes, so, you know, to give a little bit of background and details about that, again, it took place from July 7th of the year 2000 to July 17th. The Eagle Creek sale was basically a very high profile, political, contentious logging sale, and an area of ancient forest and endangered species and watershed to many, many Oregonians. And the struggle to save this area was over a decade long. And the Cascadia Forest Alliance, CFA for short, was a group that came to be in basically like late 96, early 97, and, you know, kind of took the forefront of the struggle to help save this area, even though many, many people and groups had been working even before this sale was sold, which took place at the end of 96. Again, going back to the Oklahoma City bombing real quick, it's kind of interesting because that also resulted in legislation getting passed that had a rider attached to it. What Congress does habitually is they'll pass this legislation and add what they call as a rider, which is a completely unrelated part of the bill and legislation. But once the actual bill gets passed and turned into law, then that rider does as well. And what happened was there was a aid and relief bill basically that was passed for the Oklahoma City bombing victims, and attached to that was what was called the salvage rider. And what it did was it suspended all environmental laws basically, and all these areas that were at one point protected were now threatened and endangered and ended up getting destroyed by logging. And so that's where Eagle Creek falls into this story, because it was one of the sales, one of the last sales that was sold under the salvage rider logging, which in any other case this sale would be illegal, and because they wouldn't be able to cut because of the three main factors. It's a watershed, pure drinking water for many, many thousands and thousands of Oregonians. It's an endangered species habitat for spotted owl, and it also has some of the last bit of old growth, which, you know, in all of the U.S., especially in Oregon. So basically, it had no protection. We couldn't take it to court. We couldn't do anything except put our bodies between the chainsaws and the trees that we were trying to protect. So that's what Cascadia Forest Alliance did, and many other people, for many years struggled to stop the cutting. And they went ahead and started cutting and did cut about 30% of the entire sale, which was over 1,000 acres, the total sale. And we set up tree sits and we set up these road blockade structures to help keep the chainsaws out. And that's what we had set up early spring of 2000. We had these road blockades that that were effectively keeping the logging at bay. And on July 7th, 2000, the Forest Service raided our camp. Peaceful activists living in these structures and having base camps at the basically at these gates that the Forest Service has to keep activists out, and they basically raided our camps and put people's lives in jeopardy. It's amazing that no one was hurt or killed that day. Well, people were hurt, but not more seriously injured due to the way that they handled the activists and the basically engaged in paramilitary tactics with literally weapons and pepper spray and knives. And at the end of the day, all four people that were occupying the structures were finally yanked out of the structures and arrested. We planned a big rally to protest this and to let people know that, look, this logging sale is still going forward. It hasn't been stopped. This is our drinking water, and that these activists, these nonviolent activists, were assaulted by the Forest Service with taxpayers' dollars, and now they've put a closure on the area to basically lock us out, which is illegal because it's public land and we have the right, taxpayers and as citizens, to be on that land. So we planned this big rally around 6 p.m. That night at the Forest Service building, which is downtown in this building on 2nd and Stark, downtown Portland. And that's where the U.S. Forest Service regional headquarters is. So it controls the whole entire U.S. Forest Service logging operations for Oregon, Washington, parts of California, and I believe Idaho as well. It covers a huge area. And so we planned this rally there to call attention to what had happened that day and to, you know, protest the Forest Service and to let people know as they were going home from work and passing by on the streets what was going on. And so now I'd been downtown Portland before, but I'd never been to that building. And as soon as I arrived there and took one look at it, I thought the building and get up to that little ledge, because it looked like there was a ledge three stories up, and the building was... The brick design was such that it had little notches in it. It seemed like it could be easy enough to just free climb without any ropes or gear or anything. And I mentioned it to someone. They kind of looked at me oddly, and so I just said, well, screw it, I'm going to do it then. And I basically did it spontaneously, just free climbed up the building and got to the ledge, and I saw that it was big enough to be able to sit on or stand on. So I said, I'm staying up here until the sale's canceled. And I basically just climbed up, you know, for the moment to get a call attention to the rally, because it was, you know, the Forest Service and all the employees in the building was shut down. I mean, everyone was gone for the day. And so, you know, as far as the timing goes, I felt that it was a little bit late, and I wanted to, you know, get people's attention while they were driving by or walking by it on. And I figured if I do a little bit of a spectacle, then, you know, maybe people, you know, rally around us and, you know, be supportive. You know, again, once I got up there, I thought, gosh, you know, I should just try to stay here. And so I made the declaration, like, okay, I'm going to stay here until the sale's canceled. And 11 days later, I ended up coming down on my own accord because, you know, I was technically, according to our lovely laws, trespassing. Even though these are government offices and it's basically public entities within the government, they are, you know, conveniently located in private buildings, so they're protected by all the private property laws. So I was trespassing, and there was a court order against me, a court injunction against me from the judge who had, you know, heard the cases of both sides. Throughout the course of the 11 days, my lawyers went into court, as well as the owners of the building, you know, contending that I was hurting their business and stuff like that. And a lot of activists and the lawyers were basically supporting me and stating their case of, you know, as to why I was there, and that this is a huge, huge issue, and that it affects, you know, thousands and thousands of people. And so anyway, at the end of the day, though, the judge, you know, did order me down, and I didn't come down right away, so I was eventually found guilty of contempt of court because I didn't come down right when the judge wanted me to. On Monday, the 11th of 2000, though, I did end up coming down just because I was on private property and people were, you know, people as far as the law enforcement, the mayor, and, you know, and the people in this building were getting a bit impatient, and they had let me stay up there that long, but they weren't going to let me stay up much longer, and I wanted to avoid a potentially violent, hostile, you know, intense situation, so I came down on my own accord. Throughout those 11 days, though, it was a complete phenomenon. We generated and raised thousands and thousands of dollars just by people walking by and other people catching wind of what was going on and making donations. We handed out tons and tons and tons of flyers, and we let tons and tons and tons of people know. I think it's important to note that during those 11 days, people were awakened. People were made aware of certain things that they didn't even know about. Not just with Eagle Creek, but with McGarbage, or McDonald's, I call McDonald's McGarbage, and with the governments and the corporations and with food choices and with, you know, all the paper that's wasted, and the fact that we can do something about it and we can take action in our daily lives. And you know, these types of things I was constantly speaking about and reminding folk about, and, you know, and the outpour of public support that was around this legislation that was generated by not only this action, but just all the things that transpired around you know, the June-July month of 2000, really, you know, it created an enormous amount of support. It created an enormous amount of awareness of about Eagle Creek and other issues in general. And while I was on the ledge, again, you know, I definitely would never take full credit or even a large amount of credit for canceling the sale. I would say, though, that the ledgeship was a very key and pivotal action and point in the whole entire decade-long struggle. One of the senators, Senator Ron Wyde, who had publicly supported the cancellation of this sale, as well as many other members of legislature and city councils and so forth, he wrote a very strong letter at the time, the Secretary of Agriculture, who was Dan Glickman, urging him to at least reconsider going forward with continuing logging this, because there was such outcry and such support to have this stopped. And that strong letter to Dan Glickman resulted in Dan Glickman temporarily suspending the sale and committing to doing independent review, which took place in 2000. And then when that review came out, it took place around summer of 2000, I believe. That was a huge factor, and this review resulted in basically the Forest Service having to renegotiate and take some of the areas that were slated to be cut, some of the units, and take them out of the contract, and which resulted in Vanport Manufacturing, the purchaser of the sale, rejecting that basically, and so the deal was deteriorated and resulted in late spring of 2002, it finally was canceled. Again, you know, I want to reiterate the fact that even though it has been well documented that I don't engage in violence and that I do engage in civil disobedience, you know, more so sitting on ledges and sitting in trees rather than any kind of arson type things, those actions created awareness. They were very pivotal in helping to contribute to getting that sale canceled, and that's really why I'm targeted and framed for these.
Some men take the hard line, and some take none at all. And some just want their freedom. When they wind up behind the prison walls, there are cops on every corner, and they know what they don't like. And if you're rich, then you know that the street's no place for you at night. No, 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 no. No place for you at night.
I understand you're trying to secure refugee status in Canada.
Basically, you know, I'm a U.S. citizen. I don't have Canadian citizenship. I have applied for refugee status to be able to basically have political asylum and stay in Canada, claiming that, one, I'm being targeted and being persecuted, not because I'm guilty of these charges, but because I am, you know, an activist and I've been involved in effective campaigns, and that I can't get a fair trial because the media branded me as a, quote, T-word and has labeled me as guilty. There's no chance, there are very little chance of me being able to acquire refugee status. They basically have the stance that they were waiting to see if I'm extradited, and then if I'm not extradited, then I can apply for my refugee claim. But what myself and other, you know, and others are saying, and my lawyers are saying, is that, well, that's pretty backwards, you know, like if I might not even be getting, being able to have the chance to even make my refugee claim if I'm extradited. Canada bends over backwards to the U.S. The U.S. and Canada have like a really strong extradition treaty. Canada agrees to do whatever the U.S. wants, basically, again, as long as they're not asking the death penalty. I'm reading case law of, you know, different extradition cases, and I mean, for example, one case that, you know, someone is facing possible execution, other case, serious torture, and there's been clear evidence that there's been a breach of justice within the government and the, you know, the cases, and yet Canada is still committing them to being surrendered and turned over for extradition, and that to me is pretty disconcerting.
Legally, Trey, what's next for you?
So legally, this is where we stand. You know, again, the immigration refugee stuff is pretty much on hold. The U.S. is moving to extradite me, and we have set an extradition hearing for April 18th, 19th, and 20th. At that point, the judge, after hearing the arguments from both sides, will determine if, you know, if there's enough evidence and is accurate. You know, with the, in the case of Leonard Peltier, you know, he was extradited almost exclusively on the testimony of a witness who later recanted and said she made that testimony under intense coercion and pressure from the FBI. It's extremely difficult to beat the extradition. This whole entire process could take 2 or 3 or 4 years until I'm finally extradited, if I am extradited. At this point, you know, I've never been locked up before. I mean, I'm not a criminal. I've engaged in civil disobedience, which amounted to community service. You know, I've never spent, you know, more than a day in jail, and you know, to now be locked up almost a year has been definitely, like, very trying and very, you know, one of the most difficult things I've ever had to deal with, if not the most difficult thing. You know, I plan on stating my case and basically holding my ground and, you know, continuing to declare my innocence and continuing to, you know, to expose it to the best of my ability and the best of my legal defense to expose what the FBI has done in the past and what they're doing to me. And so, you know, I'm prepared to be, if I have to be locked up here while all this is going on, so be it. If I can be out on house arrest, all the better. And if and when I'm eventually surrendered or extradited and end up in the States, well, at that point, if all is still intact like it is today and I end up, you know, having one or two or three persons being willing to testify against me, you know, I'm prepared to go to trial. I'm not in a position to make any kind of plea bargain and you know, plead guilty to something that I'm not guilty, so I can wipe away the chance of being locked up for the rest of my life. Then I'm prepared to go to trial and try to beat it there. And, you know, again, you know, with the best intentions of being acquitted. I've never been locked up before, so there's been many, many challenges, and all this concrete and steel and stuff, and not being able to have my feet on the grass and being able to get much fresh air. At least we have a little exposure to fresh air, but it's not much. And another really, really challenging thing has been the fact that I've been targeted and assaulted multiple times. I'm a total anomaly, man, like in any kind of setting, and especially in this jail setting. I don't engage in violence, and a lot of people in here, it's basically like a form of survival, not only how they've learned on the side, but in here, you don't like something and someone's doing something to you, you know, the way to deal with it is through fighting and violence, and, you know, that's not my way. You know, that has definitely been a difficult thing, having to deal with the hostility from other inmates, and especially when I've been double bunked and had, you know, cellmates, and we've had, you know, have to be locked up for several times throughout the day in a very small area, and it's been hard physically, as far as the hostility and the tension and the aggression that I've faced.
Since your incarceration, you've been having trouble maintaining a raw food diet. After a 42-day hunger strike, prison authorities caved to your demand for raw food. You've even faced solitary confinement for hoarding zucchinis. How is the situation now?
There's very, very little raw food that's served on a regular basis here, and so that was definitely a huge challenge for the first several months. Since August, though, I'm happy to say that they finally honored my diet after me almost dying and me being in the hospital for 3.5 weeks, and my doctor saying, look, I'm not releasing him until you honor his diet. because I'm not putting them back into a starvation situation. So happy to say that since then I've been getting raw food every meal, and I'm definitely, like, I've gained, you know, all my weight back. I'm about around my ideal weight, about 145 pounds.
What does a prison raw food diet consist of, Trey?
Well, I tell you, there's not a whole lot of variety, and but again, I am grateful that at least I'm getting some vegetables. As far as the fruits go, I get, like, say for breakfast, I'll get 3 oranges, and then the next day I'll get 3 pears, and then the next day I'll maybe get 3 bananas if they have bananas in. I get some raisins, some dried raisins, which is nice.
You have 1 minute left to talk.
Shoot. So, and as far as vegetables go, or at least the non-sweet fruits, I get some tomatoes, some cucumber, occasionally broccoli. Once a month I get an eggplant. I get a whole, like, purple eggplant. let's see, what else? Sometimes some celery sticks, and occasionally I'll get some green bell pepper. That's the extent of it.
You have seconds left to talk.
It's a lot of the same things, right? Like, for example, for lunch and dinner, I'll get, like, cucumber and tomato and mushrooms. There's not a whole lot of variety, right?
You were a middle-class high school wrestling captain from Florida when you first started thinking about environmentalism. Tell us about your political development.
When I got into college, I was with different environmental groups and animal rights groups, which gave me a huge repertoire, basically like a arsenal, if you will, of sources and arguments. One of the groups was the PIRG, the Public Interest Research Group. You know, there were animal rights groups that had a lot of the issues that you never see on TV, you never read in the newspaper, and my parents didn't tell me about. I also took a couple environmental courses. I was basically not very happy with school and just kind of doing it more for my parents because, like, you know, they were paying the bill. You know, I realized that, like, you know, we have to take responsibility in our daily lives and in our own personal lives, and I didn't want to contribute to a lot of these things, so I stopped, you know, purchasing certain products from certain companies. I reused and recycled every living thing I could. I composted all my food. I didn't throw anything in a landfill. At one time, did have a vehicle, and I ended up selling my vehicle and, you know, just relying solely on biking and walking. And, you know, and again, I viewed activism, getting involved with these different groups and doing some protests and doing what I could do. You know, I viewed this as a very, very important part of educating people and exposing what's going on and helping to stop these injustices. And unfortunately, a lot of universities and colleges have animal testing going on in the biology and psychology departments. And so I found out that they were testing on these poor animals, cats and mice and rats and other animals. And a group of us, like, we'd go and chalk up the sidewalk and put big arrows in front of the building and say, hey, did you know that your tuition money is going towards animal testing right in this building? And then the next day we'd go back there and they'd wash away. They brought out these this is sidewalk chalk, you know. It was like it wasn't anything permanent. They would they'd bring in the big pressure sprayer to wash it all away before the students could see it. And, you know, we did protests and rallies. We did you know, I've done, like, the letter writing. I've done the, you know, those types of things. And, you know, I really felt it got to the point of 2000 where I had heard about treesis and I had heard about, you know, people living in trees. And I was doing everything that I could possibly do that I could think of, my food choices, my purchases, my lack of purchases, my not driving vehicles, my reusing and recycling everything. Everything that I could possibly think of to do as consciously as I could to create as little impact as possible and have honor and respect for every living thing. You know, I still was watching and being aware of the fact that waters were still being poisoned. I wanted to really step up my activism and put my body between what was being destroyed and what I was trying to protect, and that's exactly what led me into getting involved with the tree sits and the road blockades at Eagle Creek.
What kind of support, if any, have you been getting from more mainstream environmental organizations, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, those types of groups?
I know that there are a lot of people that support me, and there's a lot of people that, you know, that maybe belong to certain groups and organizations, you know, and that maybe individually support me. I haven't been aware of any that are saying as an organization that we really assist and we really support him. I sure would like to see it, you know, I sure would like to see more of it. You know, again, I definitely am very grateful for the thousands and thousands, if not millions of people that know about this case and are supportive. I definitely would like to see more organizations, you know, jump on board and really get behind my case, you know, in helping to have a, you know, a positive outcome, whether that be getting the charges dropped or being acquitted or whatever it might be.
In the last 10 years or so, the major political upheavals we've witnessed are generally referred to as anti-globalization and then followed by anti-war or anti-imperialism.
Yeah.
Do you think these movements have put forward a proper environmental analysis?
I would say no. That's been one of my biggest frustrations with working with different groups and organizations. There's not, in my opinion, enough of a holistic agenda and action when it comes to certain organization groups and movements. You know, I think it's somewhat problematic, and I understand on some level. I would like people to take a step back and look at the whole picture rather than just the one issue. For example, when it comes to globalization or anti-war movements and stuff like that, there's, you know, the focus is so much on pretty much one central idea or theme, and in my opinion, a lot of times, a lot of the other things are, which inextricably interconnect with that and end up getting affected by and are related to, you know, to whatever that central theme or focus is. Even a small example, which in my opinion is really a huge example of, you know, say organizations printing up a bunch of literature and information about their issue, whether it's globalization or anti-war movement. You know, they print it up on dead tree chlorine bleached virgin paper, you know, and that, again, it people might not realize it, but every little piece of paper and every time that we do something, it impacts the whole entire planet, you know. And I would like to see people, individuals, and especially organizations embrace more of a holistic approach to their activism, to the actions, and to, you know, what their agenda is, what they put forward. And so when you talk about the globalization and oppression and such, you know, it's not just humans, you know. It's like this globalization and the corporate agenda is so ubiquitous, and it's oppressing every living thing. It's wiping out ancient forests. It's destroying, you know, rainforests that are housing, you know, a huge portion of all plant and animal species on the planet. And of course, it's abusing humans, causing, you know, great human suffering as well. So, you know, I think it's important for folks to realize that whatever their issue is, whether it's humans, whether it's non-human animals, whether it's the environment, whether it's globalization, anti-war, all of these issues are interconnected. They're inextricably interconnected, and I think it's important for us to realize that you know, the more unions that we can build, and that is happening more too, which is great, then the better, the more that we can all succeed in stopping this oppression in all its forms.
If you were released tomorrow, Trey, yeah, what would be the first thing you'd do?
Kiss the ground.
Do you feel you've received adequate solidarity from people on the outside during your time as a political prisoner?
I mean, it's hard for me to say, right? I don't want to be too critical, and I want to be realistic at the same sense. I would say this. I would say that I am deeply moved and grateful by the solidarity that I have received. I'm super, super grateful for all people's support in whatever form it has taken, whether it's been money or food or phone calls or visits. Letters and, you know, prayers and energy and support that people are sending. And I would say that I would sure love to see more, and I think that there's always room for more. Deep suffering and trying times can also really elicit an amazing amount of growth and awareness, and this is, as hard of a time this has been, it has been an amazingly growthful time as well, and I've learned a lot, and I've been able to appreciate a lot. And there are so many beings, not just humans, but so many beings on this planet that are suffering so immensely, so unnecessarily, because of corporate greed, and it really helped put things into perspective and help me be grateful for the things that I do have, even though I would rather not be locked in a cage, and I'd rather not be facing these daunting charges and the sentencing. And I still am so blessed. I still have...
You have 1 minute left to talk.
I still am way better off than so many beings that are being chopped down like trees and being persecuted like humans and non-human animals that are turned into dinner, you know. So I am grateful for those things.
I think your selflessness through all this, Trey, has been pretty remarkable. I guess in closing, how could people on the outside help?
I would say, you know, whatever they can do, not only for me, but planet. You know, there's so many things that people can do, like be conscious of food choices, be conscious of your actions in daily life. For me, you know, we can check out the website, treyarrow.org, and, you know, make a donation.
You have 15 seconds left to talk.
Spread the word throughout, you know, phone calls and emails, and get the word out.
You've been listening to Environmentalism Behind Bars, an interview with political prisoner Trey Arrow, who spoke with Chris Arsenault on February 8, 2005. For more information on Trey's case, check out his defense website at www.tellus.net/public/Trey Arrow. To be added to the Trey Arrow listserv for weekly updates, send an email to tre@riseup.net. I'm Pierre Loiselle. Thanks for listening. Who's to blame? Who's to blame?